Hi, it's David Remnick. If you're enjoying this podcast, you might enjoy even more of what The New Yorker has to offer. Becoming a subscriber gives you unlimited access to The New Yorker, including Pulitzer Prize-winning reporting, insightful cultural commentary, and fiction and poetry. You'll also enjoy our delightful cartoons, crossword puzzles, narrated stories, and much more. This past year, our readers were gripped by Ronan Farrow's profile of Elon Musk, Heidi Blake's extraordinary tale about Dubai's runaway princesses, and much more. Visit newyorker.com to gain access to all this and more. Use the code POD15, P-O-D-1-5, to secure a 15% discount on a yearly digital subscription. That's POD15 for a 15% discount.
This is The Author's Voice, new fiction from The New Yorker. I'm Deborah Treisman, fiction editor at The New Yorker. On this episode of The Author's Voice, we'll hear Colin Barrett read his story, Anhedonia, Here I Come, from the April 18, 2016 issue of the magazine. Barrett is the author of the story collection Young Skins, which won the Frank O'Connor International Short Story Award and the Guardian First Book Award in 2014. Now here's Colin Barrett.
Anhedonia, Here I Come. Bobby Tallis possessed the drainpipe physique, knee-length Macintosh, and winsomely dissolute demeanor of a poet, or so he believed as he pursued a lavishly wayward course across the mangy municipal parks, median strips, and depressed residential quadrangles of his quarter of the city on another blustery October afternoon. One hand broodingly ensconced within a pocket, Bobby smoked as he walked and made rapid, furtive motions with his lips as if having an intense, collusive conversation with himself. Which is exactly what he was doing. Bobby was a poet. He lived in a dilapidated apartment block on the south side, inner city, a block so populated with retirees and pensioners that visitors, of which Bobby had absolutely none, often mistook it for a state retirement home. Bobby was certain he was the only resident under the age of 60. The block's corridors, the sour cream walls, lit by low-wattage sconces, downy with dust, furred, blue, perpetually damp carpeting in which shoe print impressions dolefully lingered, evoked for Bobby a budget version of the afterlife. It was at least a peaceful place, no noise but the late night dysphagic groans of the elevator's recurringly jammed doors. Bobby walked 6 miles every day. He did so because a lengthy walk helped oxygenate the creative capacities as well as preemptively dispel the oppressive sense of cabin fever that would consume him if he did not regularly remove himself from the tiny tomb of his one-bedroom apartment. Also, there was a shopping center parking lot 3 miles from his apartment block where he bought weed from a schoolgirl on a near-daily basis. The city was bound on this side by a canal, and Bobby's peregrinations tended to bring him, as now, into intermittent contact with this body of water. He noted the tarry density of its bilious murk, the tide mark of phosphorescent scum bearding the centuries-old brickwork as the canal subsided toward the stark quays and the notional sea beyond. Bobby traversed the back lane of a housing estate and detoured through a brushy interval that served as one of the numerous pickup sites honeycombing this side of the city. With a grin, he registered the dangling lobe of a used condom snagged on the branch of a bush, like a dismal festive decoration. He stopped at a McDonald's drive-thru, inhaled 3 1-euro hamburgers and a fries and a Coke, and took a spumous dump in a toilet cubicle bathed in the purple-blue glow of UV lighting installed to prevent junkies from finding the veins in their arms. In the bathroom mirror, Bobby studied himself. With his cheeks flocked with old acne scars, the sebum gleam to his macrocephalic forehead, his long, exquisitely dented aquiline nose, his favorite feature, inexpiably seedy smile, and hair, an untamable squall of dark curls. Bobby, at 29, resembled a not unhandsome, but grotesquely ancient teenager, a physical template he happened to consider the platonic ideal for a poet. Adolescence was a stage of human development at which nostalgia, that is, the awareness of mortality, first becomes fatally possible, and was the reft, the fracture out of which poetry grows. the greatest poets, so Bobby believed, lived and died without losing the furious unreason, self-consuming nerviness and malign naivety of teenagerhood. He washed his hands with pink chemical soap and resumed his walk. He wanted to be a poet but suffered from a day job, or at least a source of regular income that was at this stage a discipline almost as interesting. He was a popular house artist on the online community site All Freak Art, confecting pornographic cartoons according to the punctilious specifications of a zealously loyal and steadily expanding client base. He drew Disney princesses, anthropomorphized ponies, superheroes, video game protagonists, and cartoon versions of celebrities in endless combinations of graphic congress. His clients craved every iteration of the conventionally erotically depictable, but the medium of animation also permitted the realization of dimensions, stylizations, and acts not available to reality, and Bobby enjoyed the challenge of actualizing the more outlandish of the carnal vistas sweated up by his customers. Toward those most recherché of deviance, Bobby felt something close to poignancy. As he absorbed their anguishedly detailed requests, he realized that the purest perverts longed for a species of the poetic, for the incarnation of the impossible. And perverts were willing to pay the most. By this point, from the cartoon porn, Bobby was making something perilously close to a living for a man of his rudimentary predilections. The money came into his bank account and then came in again, like a tide. He withdrew only the minimum necessary. A healthy surplus was building, and it unnerved him. He did not want to believe in it, yet felt a swell of relief each time he thought of it. Enough money meant you did not have to think about money. Then there were the poems. Bobby had been writing and rewriting and refining and re-refining the manuscript of his debut collection for more than 8 years now. The collection was currently entitled Anhedonia, Here I Come. He regularly read from this endless work in progress at open mic nights, had even had a few of the poems published in double-digit circulation pamphlets and once reputable, now posthumous, journals. The poems, he suspected, were not good enough. They exhibited decent technical effects, but were in some obscure way insubstantial or evasive. He agonized over the accuracy of his inner ear, was not in fact certain he even possessed one. In terms of theme, he could not get beyond what he was convinced was a fundamentally spurious obsession with suicidal ideation. But simultaneously, he felt that every other poetic topic or concern was an obfuscation, an eschewal, or a bald retreat from this theme. He'd been smitten with the concept of suicidal ideation since he was a teenager, but the problem, he figured, was that he had never truly wished to kill himself. Bobby liked being alive. Being alive was, if not the best thing, then at least an okay thing, an endlessly okay thing, and his life was what many would consider a good life, or at least a serviceable version of what was probably the best available in human history. He was white, male, not rich, but not now that poor, living in a first world Western city in the early 21st century. In addition, Bobby was cursed, it seemed, with an uncapsizable psychochemical equilibrium. And no matter how much squalor and degradation he encountered, no matter how many terrible people he initiated relationships with, and no matter how many drugs he crammed into his system, he could not jar himself into a genuine spiral. Not being able to feel crushingly terrible made him feel terrible. But even this second order of terribleness had, to his inquisitive mind, a compelling textural quality that made him wish only to experience more of it. His mind found any sensation or state induced upon it fascinating, which was an indirect way of admitting that his mind found itself fascinating, which was to say that he, Bobby Tallis, found every facet of his own disgustingly mundane self and life fascinating. Bobby's psychic sturdiness was, he feared, a manifestation of a submerged but profound and pullulating narcissism. Still, duty-bound as a poet, Bobby diligently wondered about mortality, and the volitional ending of a life specifically your own. He figured that you did not want to kill yourself because you felt bad, because if you felt bad, you perforce retained access to a spectrum of emotional feeling on which was located the possibility of one day again, however provisionally, feeling good. You wanted to kill yourself, Bobby suspected. Only when the access to any feeling at all, whether good or bad, was completely eroded, when you found yourself, as many poor souls did, mired upon an undifferentiatedly flat and horizonless plane of unfeeling, bereft of access to any avenue of actual or potential emotional excitation. It was not feeling that killed, but the final and irremediable withdrawal of it. Bobby had read the literature. The state, he knew, was called anhedonia. Moving through the molting trees, Bobby saw the beige-coloured brutalist slab of the shopping centre climb into the skyline. His dealer he knew only by her first name, Becky. She was a convent schoolgirl and camogie player. She often brought her stick and gear bag with her, and sold little 10 spots of reliably mediocre weed in a corner of the parking lot most afternoons. A small coven of teammates tended to tag along, hanging back and muttering supercilious commentary in the direction of the customers. Or Bobby, anyway. He pounded across the parking lot and instantly discerned Becky in her green uniform, another person with her. Empty plastic bags stirred in the breeze. They lifted and settled, flinched like dying nerves as Bobby tramped on them. The sky itself was the color of a shopping bag. A rat, a sliver of dark muscle, darted across the concrete and vanished into the crumbling base of a low stone wall. The other person was a man, with a baby strapped like a bomb to his chest in an impressive-looking harness. Becky's come-on-wielding cohort lounged on a nearby wall, observing with studied wrath. Bobby held up between a couple of cars. He watched the transaction. Becky giggled, discreetly palmed the man a baggie as she emphatically patted the baby on the head. The harnessed baby's loose limbs waggled and its head bobbled disinterestedly around. Bobby thought of a trussed crab, unaware that it is about to be boiled alive. He picked his nose, unseated a gratifyingly intact clump of dried matter, palpated it between his fingers and flicked it away. The man, youngish with shaved blonde hair, walked across the parking lot and placed first the child and then himself into a gleaming, hypertrophied Land Rover such as a professional wrestler or a Central American dictator might drive. Bobby now approached. "All right, Becky." Becky grimaced and flexed the wings of her nose. "The usual, Bob." "Becky, can I ask?" "No." "Can I ask what your actual name is? I don't buy Becky, you see." "Oh, do one, Bob. Do you want something or what?" "You seem savvy enough to operate under a nom de guerre, as it were." "Nom de fucking guerre," he says. "Do you know what that is?" She sighed. "Becky's the name you're getting, Bob. Stop being predatory." "Predatory? You're initiating predatory behavior. Don't think I won't pepper spray your haggard ass." "I'm not." She turned to her crew on the wall. "Guess what, lads?" she shouted. "This fucking fuck wants to desecrate my puss." "Hey," the others cheered derisively. "Okay, okay, Jesus, Becky, can I just get my stuff?" "The usual?" "The usual." "Big spender," she said as she palmed him the 10 spot. "This is it, I think, Bob. This is the last time I'm serving you." "Listen, if it's about asking your real name, I'm sorry. I didn't mean..." She jerked her shoulder, indicated the lumpy appurtenance of her camogie bag. Her helmet, with its white dome and ribbed face guard, rocked against her hip. It looked like the skull of a vanquished opponent she had taken as a war trophy. "Melda's, that's the school. We've got to the county quarters for the first time in 12 years or some bullshit. We're doubling down on training sessions for the foreseeable future. And anyway, I've been doing this," she indicated the parking lot, "like 2 years now. It has a built-in lifespan, Bob. Might be time to get out of the game." Won't you miss the money?" Bobby asked. "I don't do it for the money, Bob. My scumbag parents are rich as fuck. I do it because it's interesting. But now it's time to, I don't know, grow up or whatever. Now Bobby grimaced. Don't do that, Becky. She looked at him again. She had a broad frame and dimpled knees, a clear water complexion, and streaked, tawny brown hair. Bobby considered her in a rigorously paternalistic way, very beautiful. For the first time he could recall, something in her expression softened as she looked at him. There's Mike Logan, you know him? Got a tattoo of a stripper with, like, giant titties on his arm. Now, he sounds like a character, Bobby said. That he is, Becky replied. He hangs out in the Ladbrokes on Hyde Street, Bob. He can sort you out from now on. I'm happy to vouch as to the quality of his merchandise, and I can vouch on your behalf to him. Don't take this the wrong way, Becky, but it's you I'll miss. You are all the same, she said, with an unexpected weariness. Goodbye, Bob. If you see me again, cross the fucking street, right? Goodbye, Becky, he said. She turned and went to her friends. They unsaddled themselves from the wall and the group headed toward the main street. Feeling woozily, torrentially 15 himself, Bobby stood there with the 10-spot crushed in his hot grip and a corona of flush diffusing across his pocked cheeks as he waited to see if the girl he'd known as Becky would at least look back. The Land Rover nearly struck him as he wafted towards the shopping center exit. He stood in place in order to let the monstrosity eke by, but instead it eased to a halt and the passenger window slid down. As Bobby looked in, he caught the man hastily sucking in his gut before leaning across the latte-colored leather of the passenger seat. I thought I recognized you. Huh? Bobby said. I'm not talking about from back there, the man said tersely. I was actually at the reading night in the Andromeda Bar like a month ago. I saw you read, I liked it. When Bobby did not respond, the guy lowered his eyes and said with the grave emphasis of a bad actor, I mean, you wouldn't have known I was there. Not that it matters if you did. Then he looked up and smiled. Bobby stared at his teeth, which were neatly aligned and all the same toothpaste ad hue. He appeared to be nothing more than a nondescriptly handsome wadge of heteronormative generica, tidily styleless in a sweater and chinos. But his dopily enthused expression was so innocuous, it was unnerving, and Bobby felt unmistakably an emanation, the old encoded, carnal pang. Was Johnny fucking IKEA here actually trying to pick him up? Bobby uptilted his nose to signify skepticism and also because he believed this angle resolved the geometrics of his face into their most attractive configuration. A lot of people come to those things. Actually, that's not true. Barely anyone comes. But yeah, if you say you were there, well, good for you. It's an interesting scene, the guy said. It's just a bunch of attention-starved nerds who think they can write getting up there and shiting on. Anyone can do it. But it's impressive. Anyone, Bobby repeated. The baby in her baby seat in the rear of the Land Rover made a noise. That your baby? The man shifted in his seat. Oh no. That's a disconcerting answer. The man's grin broke. He reached into the back and grasped the baby's foot. I look after the kid. It's my job, sort of. I guess I'm a sort of the nanny. A nanny? Manny? Nanny? This is my half-sister, actually, Saoirse. Saoirse get high with you or what, then? Well, the man blushed. No, but she's a good accomplice. Ha ha. He actually said ha ha. Keeps quiet about me dropping on over here on these little runs. Good one, Bobby said. Another moment passed. A palsied silence settled between the two men. If one of them did not offer something in the next few seconds, the conversation, such as it was, would die. Bobby stymied an inner disgust, sighed, and said his four least favorite words in the world. So, do you write? Bobby saw it straight away, the reflex of flinch and bristle. I'm trying, the man admitted. I mean, I'm not any good. You'd fit right in then, Bobby said at the Andromeda. No, man, you're on another level to what I'm doing. Bobby shrugged. There's always more levels. He removed his hand from his pocket, the baggie dangling between his fingers. Now, if you'll excuse me, I need to go get lightly spaced. The guy lunged at the passenger door, pushed it open. Look, I detained you enough to offer you a lift, at least, if you want. Guy's head came swimming up out of Bobby's lap after a long minute of sudsy, ungainly fellatio. He blinked like a man who has just been jarred from a deep dream, eyes bloodshot and tear-filmed. He put his forearm up to his humid mouth, seemed to sink his teeth into his flesh and made an anguished noise. "It's okay," Bobby said. "I'm just too worried about Saoirse." "Yeah." Bobby turned his head and saw a flesh-toned distortion of his own face in the partition of tinted glass, segregating the back of the vehicle's interior from the front. The guy had deployed it reluctantly, but Bobby insisted he would not do anything with the baby watching. Now the guy brought the partition back down. A nursery pop jingle was burbling gently from the rear speakers. The baby had taken hold of one of her legs and was trying to guide her fat foot into her mouth, an activity she now suspended in order to smile very prettily at her half-sibling's blotchy face. "It was kind of freaking me out too," Bobby admitted. I'm sorry, this is all very weird for me," the guy said. "This wasn't premeditated at all." "You're all right," Bobby said, suddenly weary. The key now was to get out before the guy started unloading about his originary trauma or whatever. "He'll throw me out in the street again if he finds out I did something like this. In his car, with Saoirse right fucking there. Jesus, Jesus." Bobby glanced at his phone as he arranged his pants, 2 texts and 2 missed calls. "Listen, I got to go." "My fucking father, man," the guy said. "I'm sorry to drag you into this." "You're not dragging me into anything," Bobby assured him. They were parked in an alley. Bobby quickly tried the passenger door handle. The vehicle was centrally locked. "I do have to go, though." The guy sighed again. "Fuck it." He reached across Bobby and popped the glove compartment. He took out a small wallet and removed from that a baggie of powder, nipped it open, licked and dipped a finger, ran the finger round his gums. Then he eyed Bobby again. "Want a bump?" he said in a choked tone. "I'm absolutely good. Let me out, please." The guy looked confused, even injured for a moment. Then he pressed the relevant button. Wait, he said as Bobby stepped with relief into the alley. "I know I fucked this up, but I wanted to see if I could show you some of my work. Could you do that? Could you look at it for me?" He held up his phone. "Can I just get like your email or a Twitter handle?" "I only read hard copy," Bobby said. "I'll print it off and send it to you," he said, holding Bobby's eye with a kind of ruthless helplessness. Bobby felt the warmth of burdenhood settle on him as he spelled out his address. "Poems?" Bobby asked. The guy shook his head. "Some. There's a screenplay, some stories too. It's the language, though. I just want to know if it's doing something interesting or not." "I can't help you, man." You can. The guy dipped, ran another dab of whatever was in the baggie round his mouth. He was, Bobby had to admit, an intriguing mess. He had no doubt the guy would send him his stuff, and he had no doubt it would be magisterially self-pitying, and not in the good Robert Lowell kind of way. The guy insisted on shaking hands before allowing Bobby to walk off. As he stepped out of the mouth of the alley, Bobby checked his messages. Then he realized he was abandoning an infant to a vehicle under the operation of a man kneading tinctures of a patently illicit substance into his face. Bobby turned and looked back and waited to see if there was anything obvious he could do. The vehicle began to move. He watched it complete a spasmodic reverse, trundle toward the far opening of the alley, and then it was gone. Normally, Bobby would have ignored or evaded Fiacre Calhoun's midweek afternoon overtures, but right now he needed a drink. Fiacre Calhoun was in his customary nook at the rear of the Andromeda, which at this hour was near empty. Jess Toombs was with him. Fiacre's resting expression was raked in and solemn, like the heap of cinders left after a fire has gone out. Bobby knew Fiacre took on this appearance of incinerated introversion only when he was absolutely blitzed. Sober or moderately soused, he was an animate, wryly handsome 52-year-old poet, essayist and workshop leader, and the senior editor at, in Bobby's opinion, the country's sole, remotely respectable poetry publishing house. Hammered, he looked 200. He raised his ashen lids and grinned wobblingly at Bobby. "How is the man?" he said. "Well," Bobby said. "Hey," Jess said. Jess had a straight fringe and feral blue eyes. She was in college and served as a kind of all-purpose intern/assistant to Fiacre. She was writing poems, of course. She was sitting with one leg tucked under her on a battered leather chair and appeared to be stone sober. "What's happening, Fiacre?"
"Ah, we're celebrating."
"Just the two of you."
"Well, there's three of us now," Jess said.
"What are we celebrating?"
"It's a dismal Wednesday afternoon, yet we have warmth, seats, wine and friends," Fiacre said.
"And someone's wrote a book."
"Everyone's wrote a book," Bobby said. But as he did, his heart spasmed fretfully in its chamber.
"Congratulate Miss Toombs," Fiacre said. "We're putting her out next spring."
Jess looked abashedly down into her drink. Bobby had an immediate urge to punch both of them in the face.
"That's so great. That's so great," Bobby heard himself incontinently reiterate.
Jess Toombs.
Jess Toombs. Who and what exactly was Jess Toombs? Bobby logged what he knew of her. A student, a kid. She was an unfailingly polite and pleasant human. Conscientious, patient, and kind with anyone she encountered. She formed rapport easily, and a rarity in the scene, Bobby had yet to encounter someone willing to say a bad word about her.
She was writing, but had been purportedly reluctant to show the poems to others. Bobby had offered to critique them more than once. He'd heard her read a couple of them at a night. They'd been pretty good, actually, maybe, he thought now. Bobby's head swam tritely. It wasn't even a question of whether or not she was objectively better than them, it's that Fiacre had thought so, and soon others would too. Fiacre had published a number of individual pieces by Bobby over the years, in various journals and anthologies, had put him in every live reading lineup going. Not that he thought he'd be Fiacre's next guy, necessarily. He just wished now that it was anyone other than the baby-faced Toombs. Though he knew that this qualification, too, was a lie. He would envy and despise all who were not he if he was not the one. "We signed off on the contracts in the office at noon. Been here since. Good that we could rely on at least one layabout to answer the call to quietly celebrate," Fiacre said. For the next 10 minutes or so, Bobby interacted. He choked out questions, smiled, and nodded meaningfully at replies. He was trying to interpret Fiacre's tone, whether it contained a buried note of contrition, or at least an awareness of his having, from Bobby's perspective, rejected him for Jess. There was the gruesome possibility that Fiacre simply expected Bobby to take developments at face value and be happy for Toombs. Bobby excused himself. In the toilet, he closed his fist, hyperventilated, and punched the metal hand dryer. He looked at his hand. He was pretty convinced he had broken something in his middle finger, through which a steady and piercing voltage of pain now vibrantly coursed. Bobby went back out and drank 5 pints. Fiacre, with a significant head start, but still intent on trying to keep up, rapidly became unintelligible, then unconscious. Jess ordered during each round, bought her own, yet seemed to sit before the same glass of wine, drained to the same unvarying depth all night long. "Do you feel good?" Bobby asked, for it felt like the 100th time, though it may have been the first time he had actually said it out loud to her. Jess took her time before answering, as she took her time before answering any question. She was looking at him. She had the vigilance, the remorseless patience of the endemically ambitious. And there she sat, 21 or 22, and wreathed in all her untradeable surplus time, watching not just Bobby and Fiacre, but also somehow herself, insinuated within, yet in some way already beyond, already extricated from this scene, this moment. Bobby could see now the abiding apartness in her look. It had always been there. And within him rose again the habitual suspicion, the deep intestinal hunch. His work was shit. So, essentially, was Fiacre's and everybody else's. But Toombs, whatever it was not. Jess Toombs was going to last, and Bobby could feel himself in her spectral, incipiently canonical gaze being transubstantiated, molecule by molecule, into obscurity. Whether she knew it or not, and Bobby hazarded she probably did not, she was killing them all so that she could go on, so that she could make it. This was how the machine worked. "I do," she said, in a voice so low, it sounded as if it emanated from inside Bobby's own skull. He looked at his phone. It was getting late. The bar had filled up. He wanted to cry. He put his hand on Jess's knee. She looked at his hand. "What is that?" she asked. "I don't know," Bobby said. He withdrew the still aching hand, yawned, closed his eyes and pinched tears from his lashes. He was very, very drunk. "I am very, very drunk," he announced. Fiacre was snoring, head back against his seat. The insensate son of a bitch was always right, which meant he was right about this too. Jess picked up a beer mat and Bobby watched her place it down in almost but not quite the same spot. The discrepancy or adjustment was deliberate. Everything she did was deliberate and precise. She was curating this moment as if it were already an old, old memory, and Bobby felt like an incidental fixture within that memory, wavering and thinning and becoming increasingly indistinct, mnemonic collateral on the cusp of disintegration. He stood up. "I'm so glad for you," he managed, and he walked right out. First he saw the pale humps, then he saw what they were. Old people, huddled on the pavement and some seated or even lying on the grassy embankment outside the apartment block. Some were in pyjamas, some in overcoats, some with their blankets draped over their shoulders. A young man and a young woman were moving alertly from person to person, talking to them, placing a reassuring hand on a shoulder. As Bobby staggered up to the building entrance, the young man jogged over. He had a denim shirt on with the sleeves rolled capably up. "What's up?" Bobby asked mildly. "Gas leak." "Extremely potentially dangerous," the young woman, joining him, exclaimed. Bobby ignored them. He took out his key and went to open the door into the foyer. "The gas company said to stay out of the building," the young man said. "No unlocking doors and no naked flames inside or in the vicinity of the building." "The fire department is on the way," the young woman said. Bobby absorbed this information and blinked heavily. It was not information he required. "Look, lads, I'm bone tired and substantially cut. I just want to get into my apartment that I pay the rent on and am allowed into whenever I like and go to bed." "Sir," the young man said, his face wholesomely indignant. "You don't understand. This is an emergency situation. We came over to visit my grand-aunt May and were greeted with an incredibly heady smell of what we are convinced is leaking gas in the second-story hall. We went from door to door to advise people to get out." "As instructed by the fire department," the young woman vouched. "Ah well," Bobby said, "I'm on the third floor anyways." "The whole building's potentially unsafe," the young woman said. She was also in a denim shirt, pink to the young man's baby blue. Her expression as sincerely vexed as his. They were dressed like an unironic country and western duo. "Do you fuckers sing?" Bobby asked. "What?" the young man responded. Bobby seized on their confusion to insert his key in the lock and deftly opened the door. He squeezed into the brief gap and held fast the door behind him as the young man tried to pull it open. "What the hell?" the girl shouted. "I'm off to bed and don't try and stop me," Bobby said. "If the place goes up, tell everybody I went in willingly." There was indeed an incredibly heady smell of what may well have been gas in the building, though to Bobby's cultivated faculties there was a faint but unmistakably herby backnote to the atmosphere. Bobby suspected grass, a specialized or customized blend, but then he was drunk, his faculties impaired. Maybe it was gas, and not some aging stoners clandestinely toking away in their apartment. Bobby went carefully up the stairs. He tried to recall the things you were meant to do and not to do in order to avoid conflagrating yourself. Ventilate space where possible, no naked flames, and be careful touching things lest friction prompt a spark of static electricity, something along those lines. He unlocked his door and went into his apartment. He opened a window. He booted up his laptop, began preparing a joint with Becky's weed. He checked his mail. One of his oldest and most reliable clients, Pussy Splitter 112, was back with a new request. "Good old Pussy Splitter," Bobby muttered. Pussy Splitter 112 had gone to the effort of typing up the commission as a Word doc, and when Bobby opened it, he saw it was almost 5,000 words long. He skim-read. Elvish princesses, fisting, a dash of coprophagia, an extensive and almost clinically dry segue, hypothesizing how best to depict a dragon's hard-on. The usual. Bobby was considering upping his rates. He would start the job tonight, he figured, if he could just take the edge off his drunkenness with a bit of a smoke. He went over to the window. Out front of the building he could see the apparitions of his elderly neighbors, the blankets swaddling their hunched frames, making them look like poorly pitched tents. He put the joint in his mouth and brought the lighter to it. Friction. He looked out across the city sky and flicked the lighter's wheel, prepared for the night to go up all around him. But the night, as the night was wont to do, rolled impersonally on. After a while, Bobby began to hear the Dopplered gulling of the sirens as the fire trucks made their approach.
That was Colin Barrett reading his story, Anhedonia, Here I Come. His collection, Young Skins, was published in the U.S. by Grove Press. His first story in The New Yorker, The Ways, appeared in the January 5th, 2015 issue of the magazine. You can hear more New Yorker fiction read by the authors on NewYorker.com and on the New Yorker app, available from the App Store or from Google Play. If you enjoyed this program, you may also enjoy the New Yorker Fiction Podcast, which features New Yorker fiction writers reading and discussing stories from the magazine's archive. This month, Anne Enright reads Frank O'Connor's The Masculine Principle. You can subscribe to that and other New Yorker podcasts by searching for The New Yorker in your podcast app. The weekly audio edition of The New Yorker is available on iTunes or Audible.com. Tell us what you thought of this podcast by rating and reviewing The Author's Voice on iTunes. Our theme music is by Jordan Batiste and Ross Michaels of North American Plastics. The Author's Voice is produced by Jill Duboff and Alex Barron of NewYorker.com. I'm Deborah Treisman. Thanks for listening.